Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, politicians, journalists, clinicians, founders, CEOs, the list goes on, who are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners will know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech business myself, which is called PopDoc, and PopDoc's Healthy Heart Check is currently the number one diagnostic test on the high street. It will give you the equivalent of the NHS Health Check in just 8 minutes using your phone and one of our test kits and the PopDoc app anywhere, home, work, anywhere you want to. So if you're interested in that, in looking after your heart health and knowing what your cholesterol levels are and knowing what your risk of having a heart attack is in the next 10 years, then head to any of the major pharmacies or directly to pocdoc.co. That's P-O-C-D-O-C.co. And thanks, as always, to PocDoc for supporting the show. Thank you also to the amazing team at UK Health Radio for the live platform. We love being live. It makes such a big difference to the quality of the content. And we really appreciate Johan and his team for everything that they do, not just for us, not just for the Health Tech Hour, but for all the presenters and all the shows on the station. Thanks if you are listening to this on demand, whether that's on any of the podcast platforms or available on all of them, Spotify, Apple, et cetera, whether you are watching this on our YouTube channel, which is at Health Tech Hour. Hi, nice to see you. Or whether you're watching this on Instagram, either on at Health Tech Hour on the Health Tech Hour channel or on my personal channel, which is Steve Roost. That's S-T-E-V-E-R-O-E-S-T. Anyway, let's crack on. Last week, we had our first show that we did in partnership with Digital Health Rewired Festival. So Digital Health Rewired Festival, I love it, and I love going as a punter, and I'm hugely honored that this show is now a media partner of that event. And we did a show last week as part of the lead up to it. So the Digital Health Rewired Festival is on the 24th and 25th of March at the NEC Birmingham. And we're doing shows in the lead up of key people who are sort of the key highlights of the event itself. So last week we had Kavita Palmer from Word 360 on, and oh my gosh, did we get a lot of debate after that show. Wow. So this her business, Word 360, is really one of the leaders in real-time interpretation in the NHS. So her services last year alone in London were offered in over 167 languages, which is incredible. And she can do them, her business can do them in over 400. And this created a huge amount of debate online about whether it's the NHS's obligation to offer effectively infinite language access, where its obligations stop, how does this play into the immigration debate? Why aren't we using Google Translate? The whole thing really was really interesting. So if you're interested in that, I can recommend listening to that show. Kavita is a really great person and an inspiration, so can totally recommend that. And so this is the second show, and I'll introduce my guest in a second. But just quickly, if you've not heard of Digital Health Rewired, it is the UK's leading digital health expo. It brings together the best of the NHS, business, tech, innovation, researchers, funders, investors, scientists, all at the NEC. And like I said, 24th and 25th of March, and you can get a 10% discount on your tickets by using our exclusive Health Tech Hour code, which is RW26HTH. That's RW26HTH when you buy your tickets. So today we have the second show in this series leading up to the amazing Digital Health Rewired. And we are talking about something completely new for the show today, which is great, which I always love doing. We're talking about the data science behind orthopedics, specifically hip replacements. Now, the hips don't lie, as they say, except sometimes they do. And the way that my guest today and his business has been looking at this is to try and connect an extremely large data set of what hip replacements have been done with longitudinal outcome data so that they then can provide the healthcare system with an incredibly detailed insight into this huge area. Orthopedics is one of the biggest areas of spend, and it will get bigger as the population ages. So being more efficient in that area is really, really important. So my guest today is Richard Armstrong from NEC Software Solutions. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. Very pleased to be here.
Great. Right. Let's dig in. So how did you end up in the wonderful world of data science around hip replacements?
Very good question, one of which I often ask myself. I think I've been in healthcare information for about 20 years, and it's one of those areas that once you get into it, you never get out because it's so fascinating. And I find that with a lot of my team, it's an area that's fascinating in terms of the data that we have, but also it's real and people understand the real world consequences of the data that we collect. I myself started in various industries looking at data requirements across, in fact, police to start with, moved into retail. And about 20 years ago, got involved in a hospital data warehousing project, which was again, really insightful in terms of the silos of information that sit within hospital systems and the challenges of joining that data together. Through that work, developed a really good insight into what data hospitals have and how hospitals use that data. Then got involved in a national project for the then Department of Health called the Hospital Episode Statistics Service. So all of the inpatient and then later outpatient data from across the NHS.
And had they done anything? Had they done anything like that before?
It was a very much statistical annual collection of data at the time. So it allowed the Department of Health to have a national view of activity across the country.
Okay.
And it was interestingly, and I think to some extent still is, it was a secondary purpose of the data that's used to transact the payment between payers
Yeah.
and commissioners. So the
Definitely.
statistics were sort of a sort of byproduct of allowing hospitals to charge for the services that they delivered to the commissioners.
And how manual was that back then, or whenever that was? Like, what was the, you know, when
20
people
odd.
say, I like when people say, like, oh, you know, projects to collect data. Like, what does that mean? Because we hear that all the time. You know what I mean? What, give us some flavor about what it was like.
The systems were in place, but I think there was each hospital, and I think to some extent still the case, had to provide the extract in the defined format to go on a monthly basis to this national service for processing and collation. So there was a lot of manual work involved in each of the hospitals. You could imagine, being in the world of data, the issues of data quality and
Yeah.
assuring the quality of data that was provided. So a lot of variation
Yeah.
in terms of the quality, completeness, and also to draw conclusions from the data, the way that the data was coded. So each of the data had clinical coding associated with the conditions of the patient and the treatments that the patient had had. A lot of variation in how those things were coded.
Okay. But
So
is it, was it? We're not talking about people writing stuff down with paper at this point, right? There was
no,
it was in an electronic format.
it was an electronic format. Yes, thankfully,
Thank
thankfully.
goodness. Okay. So 20 years ago isn't that long ago. So
Yeah, I think a
yeah.
lot. So interestingly, at the time, I do remember going working in hospitals when we were doing the data warehousing and looking at the records, the patient records in the hospital. So what we were capturing electronically was a small subset of the patient file, which was huge and contained lots of information. So a lot of stuff was still and to some extent still is manual in the
Yeah.
hospital, but increasingly what's captured digitally obviously is a much greater proportion of that patient record.
And what was it that you kind of, what got your engine running, so to speak, about the data and the statistics and stuff like that? Like
So it was a really exciting time to be on that project, because it was the time that it moved from an annual data collection with a sort of annual report of statistics into a recognition that there was value in providing this information back to providers, commissioners, researchers on a more regular basis. So we got heavily involved in building tools that presented the data back. We got involved in a service called NHS Comparators that allowed primary care organisations to understand the data from their local perspective and look at comparisons, their data versus all of the other providers and commissioners at the time.
Right.
And it was sort of early foray into what's now a very mature market in providing benchmarking services back out to providers, utilizing the data that had been captured. There was always excitement in terms of new things that were being developed at that point in time, because of that journey of going from a sort of an annual snapshot into a more regular use of the data. And I think that journey has only just continued in terms of realization, the value of the data that sits there.
Yeah. And was anyone against what you were doing? Was anyone like complaining?
Oh, so yes, and we'll get into that for sure. But absolutely, I think once you start putting comparators together, once you start applying statistics to the data, there's a lot of concern both at the provider level. We weren't producing anything at clinician level at that point, which we do in the registries, but that was very much provider level activity. But you have to accept that providers have different patient demographics that they're servicing, provide different levels of care for patients. And so there's absolute sensitivity. If you just publish something and say this organization looks better or worse than this organization, a lot of scrutiny behind the statistics that you present. So there's certain things that's very safe to do, counting activity. But once you start to analyze that data and start to give a view about, you know, quality of care, safety, outcomes, a lot of sensitivity and a lot of, you know, justified concern about comparing apples for apples.
And this is this league table concept, right? Where, the you know, every now and again, we decide that we're going to do another league table, you know, and presumably league tables are completely impossible without the type of data that you're talking about underpinning them, I suspect.
Depending on what league table we're talking about, if I was to do a league table of activity, pretty easy to do and uncontentious. If I was to do a league table of who is the best and worst provider, absolute minefield. Very, you know, very controversial, and you've got to be pretty confident in the statistics that sit behind that, and actually potentially misleading, I guess, as well. So it's not just the sensitivity and controversy, it's the extent to which you can actually do that with a degree of accuracy.
Yeah, like what's the margin of error on that? Because you're talking about so many different data sets that come together in order to determine better or worse, right? Because it could be anything.
Yeah, so when we do this, as we do regularly in some of the registries that we run, very much we use confidence intervals around the statistics that we produce. We have thresholds around the power of the statistics, if you like, so the level of confidence that you can have in the results that you present. And typically that requires a reasonable amount of data before you can draw any conclusion. So in the case of orthopedics, for example, if you did one hip replacement and due to chance it was revised early, you had one case, you'd have a 100% revision rate.
Yeah.
But you cannot draw conclusions from that one case. You need a body of evidence before you can draw conclusions. So we're very mindful of the thresholds that are required before any conclusions can be drawn of the data, particularly when it comes to putting data into the public domain.
Right.
we tend to prefer models where data is presented back to the individual or the organization first to validate it, because we also have the issue of the quality and completeness of the data.
Yeah.
Which we need to assure. You know, if you're missing cases, if the cases have been incorrectly entered, you don't want to jump to conclusion. So there's a process that you want to go through before you do that. But all of that said, and I guess hopefully we'll come on to talk about it, we do find cases where there is something that needs to be investigated. So, you know, there's lots of safeguards and concerns and things that you have to do in reviewing and analysing this data. But equally, ignoring it is the wrong thing to do as well.
Well, I think that's key, isn't it? Which is, surely looking at data and more time spent looking at data is better, right, than the alternative, which is to not look at it. I don't know. I mean, this doesn't seem to be like, I mean, you have to assume that the data is being analyzed properly and the data is complete and no one has a particular agenda. But if all of that is true, then surely there's only one answer, which is to just look at more data more often.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. And I think you need to have a combined set of skills to be able to look at the data in the best way. So clearly we have data scientists, statisticians who understand the methodology. We work with universities. So Bristol and Oxford University are very much involved in the joint registry. So methodological approach to it. Yeah. But really importantly, clinicians. So, you know, you've got to understand the context of the data. You've got to have the clinical context, which you're best doing if you're the clinician practicing. So understanding that is important as well in interpreting the data. But the combination of those skill sets, super valuable, and absolutely is an obligation to look at it and do something with what you find as well.
So when we were working with your team to get you on the show, I thought the NEC was obviously, I knew the NEC was a venue, right? And has been for a really long time. And I knew that NEC was involved in sort of some technical something or other, right? I knew it was like a quote unquote big company, but I didn't obviously really, at what point did NEC decide to go off and start looking into data science, health data science, statistics and stuff like that? How has that always been there, or is that recent, or like what's the deal there?
So NEC is a Japanese company, quite a large Japanese company. Our entry into NEC came through an acquisition. So we were previously working for a company called Northgate, a UK-based company that provided services mainly to the UK public sector market. Mm-hmm. But NEC core business has very much played a big investment in AI data healthcare. So it aligns nicely with what's going on within AI globally, drug discovery work, personalized medicine, personalized drug development. So there's a lot of work going on in the center that aligns quite nicely with the work that we're doing in NEC Software Solutions.
Cool.
So the heritage of the company into NEC was through an acquisition ultimately.
Okay. And you, at what point, or I guess maybe it was a continuation, but when has it grown the interest from the healthcare sector, particularly in looking at the data, to the point now? And what was that transition into orthopedics specifically?
Yeah, so to finish the story of my journey, I was involved in the hospital episode statistics work that then led into us getting involved in the National Joint Registry, where I started 20 years ago and have never left, because it's a fascinating area. That was an early stage of the registry where that actually their challenge to some of your earlier questions was trying to get orthopods to submit data to a national registry.
Orthopod being a surgeon?
Yes, absolutely. Orthopedic surgeons. Lots of concern from the orthopedic surgeon community about how the data would be used, how the data would be analyzed, who would have access to it, whether it would be published, and a lot of hesitation in submitting data for all of those reasons. So, you know, 20 years ago, there was a lot of nervousness about the registry and its motivations and where it was going to lead. I'd say 20 years on now, it's sort of owned and loved by the profession and valued by the profession, and has fantastic compliance. But that's sort of over a period of time, a long journey that has
I want to get into the National Joint Registry after this break, because, again, this is why I love doing the show. I'm sure we're a broad church, and if I didn't know the Joint Registry existed, I'm sure lots of people listening didn't know the Joint Registry existed and how important it is. So we'll be back in 2 minutes with my guest today, Richard Armstrong from NEC Software Solutions. We'll be talking, we're going to get right into this thing called the Joint Registry and understanding why it underpins all hip replacements in the UK. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movements and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Richard Armstrong from NEC Software Solutions. Same company as the NEC, different division, obviously. What we were talking about before was this thing called the National Joint Registry. So I didn't know this existed, Richard. Who decided to invent the National Joint Registry and why?
Well, great question. Right. So NJR, the National Joint Registry, started, as I guess a lot of things do, out of things that go wrong.
Okay.
There was a hip on the market preceding the National Joint Registry called the 3M Capital Hip, went into thousands of patients, was approved by the regulators for use in the market, was largely seen as a copycat implant of something that was very successful, went into lots of patients, wasn't great, bad outcomes, recognition that this thing had to be withdrawn from the market. A review post that concluded that if you had a registry, firstly, you'd be able to identify all the patients that were affected. So believe it or not, before the registry, there was no real mechanism of identifying all the patients affected by a faulty implant.
So what? Because no one kept a record of the type of implant that you have. It wasn't written down anywhere.
It was patchy in hospitals. I talked before about large files of medical records. Yeah. Largely involved somebody going into a storeroom, opening cupboards and working out who'd had which implants.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. So they knew this hip was a problem. They knew how many times they'd used it, but only by asking each individual hospital. They didn't have that data nationally. Again, I talked about the work that we did collecting national data. It didn't include which implants patients had had. So that inquiry concluded that a registry would firstly identify the size of a problem once they knew a problem was there, act as a mechanism to help the recall of the patients back to be seen by a clinician, by a doctor, but also would form a body of evidence to hopefully try and prevent these things happening in the future. So if you apply statistics to the data with some thresholds, as we talked about, being able to call these things early and stop bad implants going into large numbers of patients.
So, like, who came up with the idea, though? Like, was it like one person or like a group of punters? What happened?
It was very much a collaboration. So this report landed with this conclusion. A committee was set up, very much cross representation. So it had representation from both NHS and independent sector providers, from industry, so medical device industry, and clinicians, the patient, clinicians, the profession, and indeed patient representatives.
Okay.
An agreement was drawn up to say the registry needed to be formulated. A funding model was agreed, which in the early stages was actually...
Was it NHS England?
Department of Health at the time. Yeah, predates.
Congratulations, Department of Health. You played a blinder.
And absolutely they did, because this NJR is very much sort of, you know, globally recognised as a leader in this area now.
Yeah, and is it all joints, just hips? It's all joints.
Hips, knees, ankles, elbows, shoulders. So started with hips and knees, but as a result of its success, has extended into those other joints as
well. And you were saying, like, when it started, it was some of the orthopedic surgeons that were a little bit hesitant about submitting data. Is that correct?
Yes. I think there was a mix. There was strong enthusiasm. I think there was general consensus this was the right thing to do. But there was nervousness about, you know, it was the Department of Health, it was the government. How would the data be used? You talked about league tables before, Steve.
Yeah, was it that was the major issue? They were a bit concerned about.
What we were hearing at the time was, and again, not unreasonably, was I am a specialist surgeon. I do very complex cases. So, you know, my outcomes are inevitably not going to be as good as somebody that's doing the easy cases.
Right.
So if you just publish my data, I'm expecting my outcomes won't be as good as somebody else for that reason. And actually, you could disincentivize me from taking on complex cases. If I see a patient and I think this is tough, you know, I can't guarantee the outcome, and you're going to publish my results, then I might not want to take that case.
And did they have at the time, was it actually within their gift, the surgeon's gift, to submit that information or not?
Yes, largely. Certainly the hospital. So the surgeons, I mean, the power of the surgeons, the influence of the surgeons has changed over time.
Yeah.
Still very, you know, powerful, influential decision makers.
Surgeons listening, we love you.
Absolutely, and you know, and rightly so. But yeah, we did have in those early days individuals and organizations that didn't submit their data. And there were little in the way of sticks that could be introduced at that time to make them do it.
Interesting. And another thing, which I don't know if this plays into it, but I've come across in the last, again, my background was not in medical device sales necessarily. So but I came across a lot of people that had been selling things to be used in surgery. So mesh implants, other implants, things like that. And I didn't realize until I met and talked to these people how much discretion a surgeon actually has.
Yeah,
they have a significant amount of discretion about the implant that they use.
Yes.
Is that the case?
They do. I would again say that is changing, certainly in orthopedics. So there is, you've got hospital procurement, want to get the best price. You get the best price by agreeing a block deal. And also you have to have equipment around the types of implants that you use. So if every surgeon can choose whatever they like, you end up with a lot of equipment and a very inefficient process. So hospitals increasingly try to standardize the implants that are used, but ultimately, the surgeons are trained in particular implants, and you know, I equate it taking your Audi into the BMW dealer. You know, they've got to be trained in the right thing. You want the surgeon to be familiar with the equipment, the implants that they're using, and the equipment associated with it.
So scroll forward a bit, because I know that you've written a really great article for Rewired Health, which is around, there's a joint registry, super detailed, really up to date, almost is 100% adopted now. Like there's no hold it. It's in England and Wales, or
pretty much. Yeah. We still chase people to submit data on occasions, but it's pretty much there. Yes. In terms of 100%.
And your kind of hypothesis, or what you're seeing, is that the data in this registry now is extremely powerful in terms of leading into something called value-based procurement. So we are a broad church listening to this show. So for everyone listening that doesn't know what value-based procurement is, it's a very good idea, by the way, but Richard, how would you kind of explain to the punter on the street what value-based procurement is?
Yeah, thank you. So traditionally, we've, as we talked about, collected and presented a lot of data about the outcomes from different implants and implant combinations that will help the clinician decide what type of implants work best in what type of procedure and what type of patient. So there's a complexity to the data, because not all implants are appropriate for all types of patients. So we've presented information through the National Joint Registry, collected and analyzed data that helps clinicians ultimately decide which implant they're going to use, and what's going to work best in which patient. But there is a wide variety of costs associated with implants. Not all implants cost the same.
What's the spread? Most expensive to least expensive, roughly? I've got no idea.
In the case of hips, in revision cases, you tend to use more expensive and different types of equipment. Okay. But in hips, broadly £1,000 to £2,500.
Okay, so it's reasonably tight. It's not like one's £1,000 and one's £50,000.
No, absolutely not. But if you're doing 100,000 cases per year in the NHS, or you can see the cost opportunity. And therefore, what we are now doing is, through a partnership with a company called Advice Inc., who've got all of the pricing data for the implants from most of the NHS, not all, we're able to start to look at the price paid for these implants and marry that up with the outcome and quality of the implant, and try and give an assessment as to, if you pay more, are you getting a better outcome for your patient? Yeah. Because in some cases, it's entirely appropriate. So ceramic bearing surfaces tend to last a lot longer. So you'd think, great, well, we'll just always use ceramic, but they're much more expensive. And actually, when we've analysed the data, they work really well in certain patients, typically younger patients. They don't really make any difference. In fact, can be adverse outcome potentially in older patients, and therefore where you start to bring the cost and the outcome together, you're able to inform a value decision as well as just a sort of clinical outcome based decision.
How does the joint registry assess or access outcome data? Because I get it that people put it in when they're like, I did this many this month, and they were like the XYZ implant and stuff. But where does the outcome data come from? Because that's longitudinal.
It is. So the key measure that the registry uses is revision, and that is a part of the data set. So you'll put your primary hip into the registry. At some point in the future, that patient will have a revision.
Is that a kind of a replacement of the replacement?
A replacement of the hip. So you've had your implant surgery, and then at some point in the future you may have a revision surgery. Mm-hmm. And the key thing that the registry is measuring is the distance in time between your primary and your revision event.
Okay.
And we would expect from the average in the registry that that will be lasting, you know, your average patient 15, 20 years, for example. And if we start to see higher volumes of patients coming back and having revision early, then one of the key functions of the registry actually is then to say, what's the cause of that cluster? Is this a problem with the implant? Is it a problem with the surgeon? Is it a problem with the hospital? Is it a broader problem with these types of patients and these types of implants?
Interesting.
And that's, so that's a key outcome measure for the National Joint
Registry. And like how, because presumably, and this is just my thought process, which could be wrong, is it basically someone goes in for a revision when they're in pain. And if they're in pain, that means there's something wrong. So you don't necessarily need to track patient sort of satisfaction, because revision is a good indicator for patient satisfaction.
It's a really interesting question, actually, because the absence of a revision doesn't necessarily mean that it's been a great surgery. No, and the patient can still be in pain and actually regrets having the surgery done in the first place, which is why there's a big push around PROMs, patient reported outcome measures.
Okay.
Which is very much around questionnaires to patients, quality of life, mobility, pain assessment, questions that are asked before the surgery and longitudinally after the surgery, in order to give a much richer understanding as to what the outcome is for the patient.
Okay. But with that, is that data going to feed into, because what you're talking about is that the things that currently are in the register are objective facts, i.e.
Yes.
The number one replacement was done here. There was a replacement. There was not a replacement. Whereas that stuff is a lot more subjective. So that is that, isn't that going to be a lot harder to try and weave into the kind of model?
It is. It is. I go back to the point where we started, Steve. I think you're right. There's complexity, there's sensitivity around it, but it is a really important data set to unpick.
Okay.
And typically what you'll find is there's a lot of cases in the middle where everyone's everyone's reporting that they've made, you know, generally people have good outcomes from hip surgery. There's a really important point to say it's a hugely successful and beneficial procedure for patients.
My mum had one last summer. My father-in-law's had two. You know, like, I mean, my mum was up within a day walking around. You know, it's a remarkable surgery.
Yeah, absolutely. Life-changing transformational surgery, for sure. Yeah. But then we will find small clusters where we have, you know, really poor outcomes for patients. Mm. And those are the things that we're looking for. So the threshold for sort of drawing conclusions from the data will be pretty high. But even when you apply those thresholds, you will still typically see things that are unexplained and look out of the ordinary. And at that point, it doesn't mean that we go and start, you know, knocking on doors and shouting at people. We just present the data back to, you know, the device manufacturer, the surgeon, the hospital, and say, can you help us explain this?
And are you guys in the role of the sort of watchman here? Or you're sort of split between a few different places, if you see what I mean. It seems like, and you're actually in possession of some unbelievably powerful insights.
Yeah. So importantly, the joint registry is an entity in itself. Our role in NEC is collecting the data, analyzing the data, presenting it back. But there are people in our customer whose ultimately job it is to decide how to progress that.
Right.
But they will typically interface with the medical director in the local hospital, with the medical device manufacturer, depending on where we see a problem. Mm. Indeed, the regulator. So, you know, we've had cases where we've identified a problem with an implant, have notified the manufacturer, haven't had a satisfactory response, and they ultimately go to the MHRA.
Right.
Well, I say the medical director in the hospital would be the point of escalation for the surgeon. But the NJR is not a regulator. It collects the data, analyzes, says this looks worthy of further investigation, but the action very much is not the role of the registry.
Okay, well, we're going to go for our final commercial break now. We're going to come back, and then I really want to dig into some of the stuff that you were bringing out in your article, which was like how far this can go. You know, I think there's, well, when you're in possession of such a detailed, comprehensive data set, you know, then I think that there's lots of different places that it can go. So I want to dig into that next. So we'll be back in 2 minutes for the last part of today's show with Richard Armstrong from NEC Software Solutions, talking about the joint registry, hip replacements, and the data science that really underpins connecting outcomes to value-based procurement, which is a really interesting area. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of today's show with my guest Richard Armstrong from NEC Software Solutions, an expert in this thing that I've just found out about called the Joint National Joint Registry, which has somewhat blown my mind. So, Richard, Where could this go? Paint a picture for us. What's next? Because you're obviously probably slightly biased, but I think you would probably argue that it's had a massive impact on orthopedics already, and we must just be scratching the surface.
Definitely. So I think there's two key things to draw out in terms of where it can go. There's breadth and depth broadly. We're also involved with a new program in NHS England called the Outcome Registries Program.
Okay.
To cut a long story short, that started with, a government review, particularly into a number of areas, but MESH was specifically looked at.
Yeah.
And we're aware of the issues that we've seen in the press about pelvic MESH.
Yeah.
And the conclusion that came from that was that we've got this great thing called the National Joint Registry, and there are other good examples of registries that work well, but actually there's a lot of implant areas. I talked about the fact there was no record of who had what implants. That is still the case in a number of areas.
Interesting. So in the vaginal mesh, the pelvic mesh, which I'm sure lots of people will remember seeing in the news, it was a huge story for years and years and years. And lots of women suffered really awful health outcomes as a result. Are you saying that there was no registry for those?
That's right.
Wow.
That's right.
I didn't realize that. So even they didn't even know who they didn't even know who had had it.
That's right. So all the things I talked about, the 3M capital hip was the case in mesh,
Wow.
and until recently was the case in quite a few other device areas.
Really?
So
Wow.
an important development within NHS England is this outcome registries program,
Yeah.
largely trying to do what we do with the joint registry or what is done in the joint registry into all of the other device areas. That's a huge program, it's a big endeavor.
Yeah.
Importantly, mesh is very much in there,
Yeah.
as a breast and cosmetic implants,
Yeah.
cochlear implants.
Right.
So there's a host of new areas that are coming into that program.
Right.
So that's the sort of the breadth of what's happening
Yeah.
next, that which is really important. But
It's a
in
huge
terms of
endorsement of the NJR.
absolutely,
Massive.
absolutely. Yeah, completely agree with that. But without, there was definitely a gap. You had this sort of, if you're having your hip replaced, you had a lot of confidence that the data was going to be collected, scrutinized, analyzed. If you're having other implants, you didn't have that.
This is an example where, like, I think people listening probably assumed that there was a register. I think this is one of those things that people just think that the health service has under control and it doesn't. And people are like, wait, what? What do you mean? There's no one writes that stuff down.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly right. I think the
Yeah.
sort of patient perception of what goes on is probably
Yeah,
very
they're like, oh
different.
no, sure, no, someone's got this, don't worry. Yeah, no, definitely. Yes, and then no, we don't. But anyway, so that's the breadth.
That's the breadth. And in terms of depth, there's something, there's hugely exciting things happening in the world of data, as you'll be very familiar, Steve.
Yep.
Patient apps, wearables,
Yep.
there's a wealth of data. There's a smart knee that's come to market, so
What's that?
it's collecting its own data. So you implant it, and you have it on your app, and it tells you,
No.
generates its own data.
Richard, stop it. Hold on a second. What are you blowing my mind now? So there's an implant that effectively has its own sensors in it
Its own ecosystem,
that then it can work out how far it's moving
its
and
range of
whatever.
motion. Yeah. Whether it's
Wow.
wearing correctly.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow. And is that like, is the cost of that in line with the others or is it a lot
I
more?
think you'll find it's more expensive, Steve. It might well be more suited to the US rather than the NHS market,
Right.
possibly.
Well, right now, for the
Or
time being,
the
until.
independent, you won't find one on the NHS anytime soon, I don't
Well,
think.
that's a. I mean, yeah, but like those things are going to come down and down and down and down and down in price.
Yeah,
So.
and go back to the previous point we made. It's a commercial sector. There's a lot of marketing spin around it. Robotic surgery is another good example.
Yeah.
Where the registry can be hugely helpful is, do these things make a difference? Are you going to have a better outcome if you had your hip done with a robot than if you didn't? Well, we're now capturing that in the registry,
Oh,
and we'll
really?
soon be able to answer questions like this.
That's amazing.
So there's lots of innovation happening in the med tech sector,
Yeah.
and I think a key role of the registry is to be able to say what of that innovation is good, beneficial, where can we observe better outcomes, safer treatment, and where is it just marketing hype and
I think
something
that's
that's more
brilliant. And the
expensive.
thing is at the end of the day, in the same way that the hips don't lie, the numbers don't lie, Richard, right? So like
Absolutely.
you had the replacement done, it was done with a robot, it was done with a human, there was a revision, there wasn't a revision, the revision happened in, 13 months, 50, it's all, there's no, it's binary, effectively.
Yes, absolutely. That's absolutely right. And I think there's obviously other data that is important to supplement. So, one of the benefits of robots may be
Cost.
shorter time and shorter length of stay,
Yeah.
smaller incision. There are other benefits. So
Yeah.
you've got to recognize the limits of what the registry can and can't answer. But ultimately, it is a hugely powerful data set that is the right landing point. As you get these other data, the
Yeah.
ability to link them with the registry becomes really important. And the art of the possible in terms of the questions that you can pose on it. Almost limitless, really.
When you first started on this, did you think this is where it would be, or is this, are you in green fields at this point?
Yeah, I definitely couldn't have predicted it. No, right. That's for sure. I knew there was a lot of scope in what was possible with the data. But I guess in the early stages of the registry, it was more about persuading people of the value of putting the data in.
So yeah, it was hearts and minds.
Hearts and minds, absolutely. And the NGR now is in this fantastic place that it's won the hearts and minds. It has a rich set of data, and it has, you know, responsibilities associated with that, because you could easily produce some sensational numbers.
If you were that way minded, you could move markets.
Absolutely, yes. So you know, the registry and all the people involved in it have been very careful about managing it, how they work, the reputation, bringing all of the stakeholders on board, not sensationalizing things.
It's great.
So there's a lot of work being done with that. But in terms of the sort of where we go and what the future holds, as I said, I think there's lots of extra data that I think we'll see being developed, and think about how it can augment the registry. There's some interesting things about, we've got 5 million records in the registry now. We all know about, you know, interest in AI and ability to draw patterns in data that previously we've not been able to do.
And are you allowed to feed that into AI models?
So we as NEC know, without the permission of the NJR. So they will be very, they're actually building their AI strategy at the moment, which will define exactly that, what they do want to do. Interestingly, they have not touched on it, but the data is captured through patient consent. So we're always mindful that there's the patient has signed up to their data to be used in certain ways for certain purposes.
Yeah.
And that drives what we can and what we can't do with it. But ultimately, where it's trying to do things in the interest of the patient, make surgery safer, deliver better outcomes for patients, it's all very much within the scope of what the registry is trying to do.
Well, I mean, ultimately, it is of the state for the state, basically,
exactly.
Right? So
yes,
like it isn't, there is no commercial upside here. It's not owned by a commercial entity. It's owned and operated by the Department of Health or the NHS or some version thereof. So it doesn't really, in a sense, it is a research tool, right? So that makes total sense. And would you be, you probably don't even need to have it patient identifiable, right? You could just anonymize it for it to be useful in an AI model.
Do capture patient identifiable data, very importantly, because you go,
so you have to be able to tie it back to the,
absolutely, you're treated in hospital A and you're revised in hospital B, that becomes really important. So we do capture that level of data, but how it gets surfaced and presented, very much, you know, anonymized, so that as it's analyzed, you're right, it's completely anonymized at that point.
If you could wave a magic wand, what would be the most exciting thing that you would want to be doing, or for this to be doing in 5 years time? You'd be like, oh my god, it would blow my mind if it could do X.
Wow. So I think the it's taken 20 years to get to where we are with the NJR.
Yeah.
What I would love to do is to be able to get, you know, a real shortcut on that for all of these other device areas.
Interesting.
Learning from the NJR, taking that as the model and looking how that gets deployed into all of these other areas, which are very much, you know, in the foothills at the moment in terms of registries. And the other thing that I think is important is, which I know the NHS is very much working on, how the data can flow through to these registries sort of as a byproduct of delivering care rather than being manually entered. Because that definitely is a burden on the hospitals and probably not sustainable when you scale it
into all these other areas.
So I think for me, those are the two things.
I do think that automatic data entry or semi-automated data entry would, because how many other implant areas are there? A lot, I suspect.
Yes. Like,
That's going to be a tricky one. That's
Yeah.
an interesting one.
Yeah. And importantly, as you get into each of those other areas, outcomes are different. So success
Yeah,
in breast
revision is
surgery is
not the same thing, right?
absolutely. Yeah. So,
Great
and
reply.
we talked about PROMs and patient surveys. There are situations where you would never have a revision, very rarely. So it's more about the PROM and the patient outcome from their perspective and
Nice.
questionnaires.
Okay. And what is it that you hope to get from Rewired when you go?
I'm a big advocate of the National Joint Registry and everything that it does. Your testimony to the fact that not everybody knows about it. So
No, I think it's great. This is like, why aren't we shouting about this? You know, I mean, I think that everyone beats up the NHS and the Department of Health all the time about
yes.
lots of different things, and it drives me nuts because actually they're doing a huge amount of really cool, interesting stuff. It's just that I don't think they necessarily blow their own trumpet in the best possible way all the time. But this is a classic example of solving a real customer problem at scale in a
Yeah.
really common sense, pragmatic way.
There you go. So I'm going to be blowing the NJR's trumpet in
I
answer
just
to
think it
your
makes so much
question.
sense. It's like I don't it, it I just think stuff like this should be held up a bit more.
Absolutely, completely agree. And hence very happy
Hence
to
where
talk
we're
about it
going.
to make people aware of it.
Yeah, I think I think it's great. So in the last couple of minutes of the show, I always ask my guests the same question, which is, what is it that, you know, you've been at this for a while now, you know what I mean? 20 years, 30 years, and particularly the last 20 years, winning hearts and minds in the NHS is not necessarily the easiest. So what kind of motto do you rely on, your internal speak, your self-talk, to get yourself through those difficult times, to keep going, that you want to share with people that might need a boost?
Yeah, so I guess having been at it for 20 years, I very much try to have big ambitions, try to challenge what's possible, but also make small promises. I think that there's a temptation to sort of promise things earlier, and as I've said, it's taken 20 years to get to this point, and the route that you're going to take is completely unpredictable, and in some ways outside of many things outside your direct control. So whilst dogged determination and perseverance is really important, making small promises along the way I think is important, because I think I've seen cases where me or my team has overcommitted, and then there's a lot of work to be done to win people back again. So
Right.
it's small commitments, but with a big vision.
Brilliant. Well, look, on that note, Richard, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate you opening our eyes to the National Joint Registry. And thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with a new show.
Thank you.
You've got me wrapped in your clothes. I've never felt you so close. It's like you opened the window and in came sunlight and sea foam. Hey.